Paul, in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11, said that he had learned to be content. That is a remarkable statement, because there are a lot of people who are not contented. I suspect if we searched our hearts tonight, that some of us in this room would say, I am not really content. Or we would be concerned about whether or not we are as contented as we ought to be. Some time ago, I read this statement in an article that said discontentment has reached epidemic proportions in America. And there were some interesting things in the article, including a study of 18 to 39-year-old males. And of those surveyed, only 30% said that they were content with their direction in life. Now, the significance of that is that that is the period of time in which people are deciding their direction in life. And they are deciding, is this really what I want to do with my life? And are these the goals which I wish to achieve during my working years? These are times when a person selects a career and perhaps reaches the certain goals in their educational levels. And so to be able to say that one is content is not really a very common thing. I want us to study about that tonight and see some things that God's Word has said about contentment. And then perhaps we, with Paul, will be able to say, I have learned to be content. Solomon, in the book of Ecclesiastes, writes about contentment and actually great discontentment time and time again as he develops thoughts about the experiment that he has made to see what was good for the sons of men that they should do on this earth all the days of their life. And as he tries various experiments, he ends each of those by saying, this is also vanity and a striving after wind. And that is a parallel expression to saying, that didn't bring me the satisfaction that I had hoped that it would. As you know, he had many wives and concubines combined, about 1,000. And he was in a position to have whatever he wanted as far as pleasures were concerned. He did not, he says, deny himself anything that he looked upon that he wanted. His possessions were so great. Through the years, if you have read about him in various commentaries, there are amazing calculations of what his wealth must have been. He was a man who enjoyed beauty, and that brings for many people a great sense of satisfaction and somewhat contentment. The opening picture of that slide, I thought might create in us the thought of contentment and sheep and green pasture and peace. And so he was able to create parks and develop pools of water. Architecture was in his way. He was one who liked to design and build, and he had the capacity to do that and had the cooperation in that time of peace during his 40-year reign to enlist the help of surrounding nations even in that. Much silver, much gold. And so here was a person who had it all, and yet the conclusion that he drew at the end of each of those experiments was that this is vanity. It is a striving after wind, a statement of great discontent. Add to that the fact that when he prayed to God at the beginning of his reign, he did not ask for things. He did not ask for great power. He asked God for wisdom. And that really pleased God. And God gave him wisdom. Now, there are few things in this life that are more satisfying than that someone think you are wise. And so here was an ego satisfaction that he had. And people came from great distances to question him and to sample his wisdom. And so he had that, and yet he discovers that wisdom is not the answer for contentment. Do you know people who are always discontented? They're always wanting something else, something more, a change in life, a different direction. And they are deeply discontented, and often those are Christians. Discontentment may start early in life, and we adults may contribute to that. We want our children and grandchildren to be ambitious and to try hard and to succeed. We must be careful not to overdo that and to think that you have to be tops in everything. We could easily feed discontent. And so discontentment may begin very early. And I want us tonight to notice now some passages that deal with both contentment and discontentment, and actually want to look at some things that relate to both of those in order to better understand contentment. Paul says here in the book of Philippians, "Not that I speak in regard of need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content." Paul, in the context there, is talking about the fact that they had sent once and again to his necessity, and the things that they could not personally provide, they had figured out ways to provide for his needs. And he complimented them on that. And he said, "Now, this letter is not about the things I need. I've learned to be content." And that is a remarkable statement in the surrounding of what he actually said about contentment. He was in prison, we believe, and the deprivations of prison would be his. His had been a life full of many changes, dramatic changes. Some of them he doesn't even talk about. We wonder about his family when he, as a very pious Jew, obeyed the gospel and became a leader in the church and proclaimed the one who once he had blasphemed and worked so hard against. We do not know how his family reacted to that, and he doesn't tell us. And we wonder about that. And so there must have been many trials and tribulations. There are places, of course, where he talks about some of his sufferings, and he talks about the fact that at his first hearing before a great ruler, that no man stood with him, and though that was the fact, he said, "The Lord stood with me." And so Paul had faced a lot of things and had been through many passages of life already, and yet he said, "I have learned to be content." And so in the context of Paul's life, here is a very remarkable statement. I remember a number of years ago, in preparation for a funeral, I talked to the lady who had been widowed 2 days before and asked her, or maybe the day before, and asked her to talk to me about her husband and help me to prepare for the funeral. And one of the remarks she made deeply impressed me. She said to her husband, "He was a very contented man." She is the only widow under those circumstances who has ever said that to me. And I have remembered that because of that. It is not so usual for us to say of one another that so-and-so is a deeply contented person. And to speak of her husband that way was a very great compliment, not only to him, but to her. Contrast this statement that Paul made here with this one. In Ecclesiastes 4, "I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full, together with toil and grasping for the wind. Then I returned and saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without companion. He is neither son nor brother. Yet there's no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, 'For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good?' This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. Much gain, much hard work, much toil, and yet a lot of discontent. This individual is working and working and working and depriving himself of good. And Solomon says, what for? Why is this person striving so hard and yet is so discontented? Now, I want to connect in your mind, in order for us to get the most from this study tonight, I want to connect a sin to discontent. Often one sin leads to another. Often a wrong attitude or approach in life leads directly into certain sins, and such is the case with discontent. One of the Ten Commandments was that you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. There is a warning in those ten great commandments against covetousness, not to covet. And much covetousness is from discontentment. You are discontented, and so somehow in our minds we think, well, if I just had this, if I just had that, somehow I could be contented if I could acquire that. People used to joke in the farming community where I grew up and said, so-and-so only wants the land that joins him. If he could just have the land that touches his property, he thinks he'd be happy. Well, they were making a joke of that. That's a never-ending acquisition. And what the word covet means is the uncontrolled desire to acquire. Now, there isn't anything, no sin involved in acquiring, no sin in desiring to acquire the things that we need and that can be a blessing to us and our family. But when you put uncontrolled with that desire to acquire things, then you have discontent and even covetousness. And the effects of always wanting more are tremendous effects that really change, that color our lives, that affect our personality. One is fatigue. A lot of people are plainly just worn out because they are working so hard to acquire more and more. The proverb writer said, do not overwork to be rich, but because of your understanding, cease. Have enough sense to take care of yourself. I want you to know that when I prepare sermons that I often are smitten with the truth that I need to listen to myself. How easy to take on a second job or a third job and to work and work and work and to be so tired. And there are people who work all of the overtime that they can get, may work two jobs, three jobs, and are worn out. There is no time for quality time with one's family. There is not much of the kingdom's business in your life if you are constantly working. And you never are able to catch up with the things that you need to do at home. And so fatigue sets in because of wanting more and working for it. Debt is another thing, because as we acquire more, we want more. And the writer of Ecclesiastes says, when goods increase, they increase that eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? And so more and more and more does not satisfy. And the discontentment and the notion that somehow by acquiring more we can be contented is a myth. It simply doesn't happen. And often people go, because of our credit system and credit cards and installment plans, to acquire more and more and to over-obligate themselves. The British have an interesting expression for the installment plan. They call it the never, never plan. And that means you never get it all paid off. Well, Americans live in a land of plenty, but we are also in a land of debt and a land of discontent. And you're going to hear a lot about that in the coming year during the campaigns to convince you that if you elect this person or that person, that you're going to have much more and that you'll be in much better shape financially. Well, the effect of always wanting more and more. Americans have about 2% of the upper part of the world's wealth. People in our country who are on public assistance live at a higher level than the middle class in third world countries. Would you say that, Larry? Absolutely. And so our standard of living, even for those accepting public assistance, is very high. Our wants become our needs, and those become our necessities. I read a study that said during the 20-year period between 1980 and 2000 that the average grocery store increased in items stock from about 7,700 to over 30,000. I would hesitate to even guess the number of items at Publix and at Walmart. And so more and more increase. In a conversation a number of years ago with an older gospel preacher, we reminisced. I barely lived through that period, maybe the first 17 years of my life, but a period when in our area we didn't have electricity. And so young people, imagine a home without electricity, indoor plumbing, a home without air conditioning. And yet we didn't know that we were deprived, and our gospel meetings were 2 weeks long, and at our house we often kept the preacher. And how do you keep a guest, and how do you provide? Well, we did it. And some of you who are older know we did that, and we didn't know that we were deprived. And so our plenty, our goods have not brought great contentment. One of the effects of always wanting more is worry. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Is that not an amazing thing, that the acquisition of more and more, instead of bringing contentment, may actually create discontent? And there is much, much more to worry about, and all of those things we acquire may produce more and more anxiety in ourselves, and so discontent. And so the more you have, the more you must protect and save and invest and secure. And the conclusion is that things do not bring lasting satisfaction. One of the things that happens with the acquisition of more and more is conflict. James writes about that and says, "Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, and yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your own pleasures." And so conflict, he says that wars and fightings exist because of that desire for more and more. Disagreement over finances over and again is reported by counselors as a major cause of conflict in those who are having marital problems. Every war, someone has written, is a war of aggression. It is a war in which people are trying to take the land and possessions and things that are of wealth that belong to another nation. And so conflict comes with that desire for more and more. This dissatisfaction for wanting more and more then is pervasive in every society and in our world. Solomon wrote that the person who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This is vanity. And so that love, that desire, is a dead-end street and leads only to dissatisfaction. We will never get all of the things that we want. And thus, covetousness and dissatisfaction go together. We need things, but not as that which will give us satisfaction. Even our gifts that are given to us that may create excitement. 11 months ago, you received gifts probably at your house. Could you make a list of them now? I couldn't. And those were exciting maybe for a little while, but they do not last in satisfaction. Work and life, are you satisfied? I read of a physician who said he was so tired of sick people, complaining people, he wished he were a school teacher. 3 months off, quit at 3 o'clock. Well, when I read that, I laughed. Greg laughed. He didn't know what he was talking about. And so to think that the grass is greener on the other side is a fallacy. I overheard one of my relatives talking to his brother, and he said, Carl's preaching, you know. And brother said, yeah. He said, he stands up there and talks about 30 minutes, and they give him $50. And his brother was amazed at that. How easy just to talk a few minutes and you get $50. Well, obviously, he didn't know what preaching involved. God teaches us to learn contentment. And I want to talk to you about some great principles of contentment. And against this backdrop and thought of discontent, these will be easy for you to remember. Paul said, I've learned to be content. So I'm suggesting to you that being contented is a learned behavior, that we learn and train our mind to be content. And the first of those is to resist comparisons. Paul says we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. They measuring themselves by themselves, comparing themselves among themselves are not wise. When you start making comparisons, you can find somebody very quickly who's a lot smarter than you, better looking, better liked. The list goes on. Resist comparisons. I heard two men who were comparing their furniture, and one said, I've got some furniture that goes back to Louis XVI. The other fellow said, well, I've got some furniture. If I don't pay by the middle of the month, it's going back to Sears and Roebuck. Well, comparisons are not good. And Paul said, you'd better not do that. Resist looking at others and thinking you'd like to be like them. Two, be grateful. Gratitude is a great way for us to acquire contentment. As for every man to whom God has given riches, Solomon wrote, and wealth, and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage, and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. I believe that Solomon is saying that what I need to do is each passing moment to relish that which is good. And when we are with our families and with people we love, to nudge ourselves a little bit and say, this is good. This is really good. God is blessing me. May I share with you that I often feel that in worship services here. This is good. As I hear people really open up and sing, and as we pray and as we listen to the word, to say to myself, this is good. What would be better than being in worship services like this? And so gratitude. And you can multiply that example to so many parts of your life. Three, we ought to be, as we think about being grateful, we ought to think about what past generations have gone through and not get caught up in the when-then philosophy. We often think, well, when I get out of college, when I buy that home, when I get that job, when I retire, oh, it's going to be wonderful. And we put off in our minds contentment to another time, another place. We are very unwise in doing that. Happiness and contentment are choices that we make. And so we need to do that. Three, helping others feeds our contentment. One of the great joys that many people in this congregation are experiencing, you know that joy of using your time and talents and resources to help others. And it gives you more satisfaction to do that for others than it does to acquire it for yourself. May God help us to develop that into a very fine art in our lives, that we are constantly finding great contentment and satisfaction in helping others, to lead others to the gospel of Christ and to influence and to encourage every good thing that we can do, and thus contentment. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul wrote, "Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good. Let them be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up in themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life." There are four principles in here, and they all relate to our ability to develop contentment. Number one, don't be haughty and proud because of those things you possess. Number two, certainly do not put your trust in money. Use those things that God puts in your hand to do good and to use it cheerfully. We're not to give begrudgingly, and that applies not only to our Sunday contribution, but in our efforts to help others, to do that freely without expectation of praise or return. And when we do that, then we will be ready for the fourth principle, and that is to establish eternal priorities. When we realize that our vision, I think this was mentioned this morning, while we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. And so the eternal verities, the eternal things for which we look and long and fix our attention on, that brings us great contentment. Do you love to think about heaven and think about being with the Lord and the saved of all the ages, and to engage in wonderful, unbelievable singing and praise to God? That's good. That helps us in our development of contentment. Look around you. Everything you see is temporary. These benches, the bodies of the people, our own body, everything decays and rusts and deteriorates and dies. But there is that which lives forever, and that is your soul. And so to concentrate on eternal priorities will help us to be content. Fix your attention on God and relationships and love and care and concern. All of those things are things that relate to the eternal and will help us in our contentment. Quickly, some conclusions. Number one, you can buy a bed, but you can't buy a good night's sleep. That comes from a good conscience and being content. And to be able to pillow our heads and to really deeply rest, you can't put a value on that. And that comes from contentment. You can buy things, But you can't buy faithfulness. That has to come from within, and it has to be because you are committed to the Lord, and every day you renew that commitment and ask Him to help you and guide you to look for opportunities to do good and to be a blessing to other people. Paul wrote to Timothy, "Godliness with contentment is great gain." And so I challenge you, and I challenge myself to think of that which is great gain and to really be contented as we serve our great God. May God help us to do that. I thank you very much for your attention. I've gone a little longer than usual. Do you have that contentment in your life tonight? You can have it when your conscience is cleansed from dead works and you have decided to serve the true and the living God. When you have made up your mind that I will obey the Lord in everything that He said to the best of my ability. Maybe tonight you need to obey the gospel and come in simple trusting faith, turning in repentance, willing to own and confess Christ and be baptized. And then as a Christian, to lean on Him every day.